Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ho, ho, ho! Ideas in writing!
Hello, I'm Philip Holden, and this is Ideas in Writing, the podcast where we use words to discuss words that are written, spoken, sung, heard, or even unspoken. Maybe those words are just in your mind. We're on episode 7, and as you might have noticed from our theme tune, it's a kind of Christmas special. In this episode, I talk to the wonderful and very wise Ian McMillan. He's a poet, first and foremost, but he's also a writer of prose, newspaper columns, plays, and he's known in village halls around the nation and to the audience of Radio 3's The Verb, and you've probably seen him on BBC Television's Countryfile as a presenter and performer. We talked about his origins in Yorkshire. He was the son of a pair of romantics, and he tells the story of his mum and dad, and the support they gave him that enabled him to carve out a career as a writer. We talked about his daily walks, his daily tweeting, and his daily cup of tea, and we talked therefore about the discipline of writing every day and his ambition to have a daily newspaper column. So if there's any editors or commissioning editors out there, you know who to contact. Before we started recording, Ian apologised that he hadn't listened to earlier episodes, and yet he chose the word palimpsest, which kind of brings us into a full circle to our very first show. We had to talk about that. My word was theatre, and you can find out why we chose these by listening to the episode. It was a fun chat, and we've already agreed that as soon as it's possible, Ian's going to come down and visit the bookshop and do some kind of real event for Mr. Books. So here it is, palimpsest, theatre with Ian McMillan. So, Ian, thank you very much for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Well, thank you for asking me. I do think the podcast space is the most interesting space. It's like a bookshop, in a way, a podcast, isn't it? Because you can browse around it, you can wander about. I suppose it's a bookshop that's always open, that is never closed. That's the great thing about podcasts, isn't it? You can listen to them wherever and whenever you are. So it's kind of like a mobile bookshop that never closes. And see, I'm getting further away from my bookshop analogy as we speak. That's how it feels to me.
Yeah, but I think you're right. It's that what I found really interesting is the ability to explore things and not have, you know, it's not like radio in a way. And you're very experienced on radio, where you've got a very kind of tight schedule. And if you're interviewing somebody, it's got to be whatever it is, five minutes, and that's it. And I guess Radio 4 is a bit better than that in many ways, but still, there are time constraints, aren't
they? Well, they're tied to a schedule. So, you know, you can make a 30-minute program, 15-minute program, 45-minute program, very occasionally a one-hour program. The beauty of the podcast is that it can last 7 minutes or it can last 2 hours. And they really are breaking down that idea of what a program length is. And it reminds me of that thing that used to be on Channel 4 when it first started. There was that open-ended discussion program. Remember that? It was called something like Voices.
Or was it? Towards the end of the evening.
Yeah, and it would just go on, and it was open, and it would carry on till 2 a.m. And that's somehow how I feel about podcasts, definitely.
And I think it's great that...
Hear somebody at the door.
The cat coming in. It's the cat going through the cat flap. That's the other thing about podcasts, isn't it? Last time I was talking to the Rickard sisters, who've published this... Ragged Trousers Philanthropists as a graphic novel, and halfway through we had to stop. Well, we didn't stop, actually, we carried on because the bin men came and Scarlett was worried that they'd come on the wrong day. So
that's the beauty of the podcast, isn't it, that it doesn't have to take place in the sacred BBC studio, and then you do, because of that, get a sense of eavesdropping on people's lives, I think, most definitely.
And that's, I mean, I've got in front of me a copy of To Fold the Evening Star, which is, you said that in a non-committal way.
I was always pleased with the title of that. I think it's, sometimes I'm not pleased with titles, but I was quite keen on the title.
And where does the title come from? Sorry, I should explain to people that this is the latest collection, isn't it?
Yeah, I've done a couple of pamphlets since, but this is the latest book. And it was just, I think one of the poems in the book just mentions it in a line. It was just the idea of, I'm always, and it's an old thing in a way, but the titles and the names of newspapers, like, you know, I'm just going for the Sun, the Star, and the Mirror, which feels, I don't know, it feels almost like ancient science. And so the idea of folding an evening star just struck me as a resonant phrase, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy this book. I mean, it's. I recommended it to someone. I don't know whether I mentioned this to you, maybe via Twitter, because that's how we first kind of got in touch with each other. But somebody asked for a book that they could keep in the glove box of their car.
That's right. Yes, I remember that. Yeah, that's good. That's
yeah, good. And she wanted something that she could, you know, if she was waiting for someone or stuck in traffic, I suppose, she could just pick it out and read. Yeah. Something and it does that. I mean, the pieces are so different. I mean, it was really opened my eyes, because I think there's all kinds of prose as well, and poetry in there, and different kinds of poetry.
Yeah, there's poetry. I often get asked to write poems for occasion, so there's some of that. There's bits of prose, as you say. There are little stories, and I just like the fact that there are lots of different kinds of writing in it, and I think that should be a lesson to us all as writers, that you don't just have to write one kind of thing. So I'm lucky enough that somebody will every now and then ring me up and ask me to write something about something very specific. So, for example, somebody wrote me, I had to write a poem to go on the outside of some a folder that first edition stamps went in, and that was an odd thing to do. And then sometimes you get asked to write things for commercial purposes, like I was asked to write a thing about pork pies, and you got to try and make it a poem that works on its own merits, but also will work for this wider audience who aren't necessarily a poetry reading audience. So I do love that idea of being able to turn your hand to any kind of writing. And that's why I'm such a big tweeter. As you know, I tweet all the time. And I get up very early in the morning, go for an early morning stroll, tweet about that. And that's just me forcing my brain, as though I've commissioned myself to write something new about the same, it's always the same walk. I just walk out the house, round the village, back in the house, takes about 40 minutes, and I pound my brain to try and see something new every day. And to me, that's what writing is, pounding the brain to see something new, and then sometimes being asked to write something. And because you're used to pounding your brain, then it becomes a little bit easier, I think.
Well, yeah, it's a real lesson, I think. I mean, my son, who does a bit of writing, did a I guess it's a kind of writing course at the Royal Court, I think. And one of the things he came back with that stuck with me was don't get it right, R-I-G-H-T, get it written.
Yeah, that's dead right. Yes,
and
yes,
because the idea about just getting something on the paper.
Because often when you're commissioned to do something, you think, gosh, I wish I'd got another 3 weeks, another half an hour.
Yeah.
But then you have to write the thing and you have to send it off. And then you read it, you think, well, you know, that's all right. But another month, it could have been better. But then you're right. Don't get it right. Get it written. It's definitely that. That should be on every writer's wall of their room that they write. Yeah, definitely.
And so that was the thinking when you, because you've been on Twitter quite a while.
Yeah.
And you must have written something pretty much every day.
Yes. Well, Twitter, I wasn't on it. But then one of my producers at The Verb, my Radio 3 show, said, Ian, I think you ought to go on Twitter and just tweet every now and then and maybe do one tweet a week or something, let people know. And then I did a couple and I suddenly thought, I like this. I like the fact that tweet something that's not a poem and that's not a story and that's not a novel, but it's just a tweet. And it's a thing and it's quite funny or it's serious or it's thoughtful or it's throwaway. And that's the key word, throwaway, it's gone. Tweet it out there and people either like it or they don't. But it doesn't matter because in a moment there'll be another one along and it'll arrive. And that's what I like about it. And it really concentrates the mind. Some of my heroes on Twitter, people like the great Moose Alain. Moose Alain just does the most amazing tweet. He's great, isn't he? And they're funny, they're serious. One of my favourites of his is, I'm going to build a model of Mount Everest. Is it to scale? No, just to look at. Oh, clever gags like that. The gags and a bit more. And I think that's what Twitter makes you do. So, yes, I do. And it's thanks to The Verb asking me to tweet. And now my wife says that I tweet too much, which is probably true. But it doesn't have to make you think. It doesn't have to make you, it gets your brain going in the morning. And I do try and steer clear of the horrible cesspit. If anybody says anything nasty, I'd get rid of them because I think that our corner of Twitter should be full of joy and excitement and adventure and discovery, I think.
Oh, in that case, I'd like to apologise for some of my tweets.
Oh, well, no. I mean, the person I feel sorry for is there's quite a few people, there's quite a few Ian McMillans, and it's not an uncommon name. But people go, oh, I am not Ian McMillan the poet. People keep tweeting other Ian McMillan saying, what does that mean in that poem? And he says, I can't help you there.
But there's two things you always tweet about, and there's your walk and there's your first cup of tea.
Yes. But the walk, so I try to tweet something when I wake up. So I wake up and then I tweet a pre-walk tweet just to get myself on the starting board. But I'll tweet the walk, as you say, and then I started tweeting my first cup of tea because I do like a nice cup of tea. And then that's become another challenge to me, to always think of some other way of describing my first cup of tea. Yeah. But to be honest with you, that time of day is my best time of day. You know, we're recording this in the mid-afternoon, and that's after this, I will start to fade away. I'll start to, one or two of the boilers will start to shut down. There'll be a bit of wind going out of my sails. I tried to go for an afternoon stroll and an evening stroll under lockdown. I've been doing a lot more walking. But I find that I couldn't write a tweet about my evening stroll, I don't think, because it feels to me that it's a lot, we're all different, but my creative juices flow like a river at the start of the day. And then after about 4:30 in the afternoon, my wife will tell you that, you know, this evening, obviously, and I think I might just listen to a nice concert on Radio 3, and she'll say, yes, I'll give you 5 minutes. I'll have gone. Crashed up.
Yeah.
Like my dad used to. So it is, and so the first cup of tea and the early stroll tweet and the morning tweets, they're me, I guess, celebrating the fact that I'm feeling quite fecund at that time of day. And that's why the tweets tend to tail off in the late afternoon and the early evening.
I wanted to, before I forget, because I generally do forget, is for us to exchange the words that we've brought along. I don't know whether you want to go first.
I can go first. But you go first, Philip.
Well, Well, I was just going to say it ties into, I think, to what you were talking about, this sort of bashing the brain to write, and the variety of work that's in the book, as I say. But my word was going to be theatre.
Oh yes, theatre. What a fantastic word that is.
It is, isn't it? I think. I mean, for all kinds of reasons, whether you're into the theatre or not.
Go on, say what you like about
it. Yeah, whether you like theatre or not, what I think your writing does, certainly in this collection, is it creates spaces in which things happen. Mm. You know, so it's like you've created a space on Twitter where every morning I know there's going to be a tweet from you, and it's going to be creative and imaginative, and it's going to paint a picture. And but it's equally, you have written a play, you write prose, and it seems to me that you just find any place you can to create something. What I noticed about some of these poems, it was that they can only be read in your own mind.
Yeah, no, that's all true.
Some of them wouldn't work out loud, as it were.
Yeah.
So there's even a theatre space in the mind there that, it was a revelation to me. Anyway.
Well, you're right. I mean, that is my mission in a way, that to make a space for performance, whatever that performance is, whether it's a performance on somebody's phone, a tweet, performance in an actual physical space. And the idea of making every space that you enter a space for theatre is the thing. I mean, as you know, I love performing in village halls. That's been one of the worst things I've been able to do gigs. My ambition is to perform in every village hall in Britain. I'll never do it now, even before, because there are 13,500 or something. I've been to maybe 800. I remember a year before the lockdown, I did a little interview on Radio 4. On You and Yours, because they knew that I liked village halls. They wanted me to talk about village halls. As I'm talking about the village halls, suddenly it was like I was possessed by the demon of village halls. And I suddenly went, I want to perform in every village hall in Britain. And my agent, Adrian, tweeted me and said, I surrender. And it was an amazing thing. I've never known anything like that in all my decades of being freelance performer. Those 4 minutes of me talking about village halls on Radio 4 generated literally dozens of people saying, well, all right, come to my village hall, come to my village hall, come to my village hall, come to my village hall. I got a year's worth doing one or two gigs a week of gigs with my mate, the musician Luke, all over Britain, thanks to that. And that was creating a space. Yeah, I love the idea of the theatre space, and also the idea of the performative life, you know, that your life is a performance, whatever else it is. Performance. So that word theatre, and I love going to the theatre, but I there's that wonderful Peter Brook book called The Empty Space about what theatre can be, and it can be dead, and it can be restricted. But the idea of just somebody doing something in a space, and there might be other people there, or they might be somewhere else, because one thing that's going to come out of all this is the hybrid thing, isn't it, where there'll be some people in the room, and there'll be some people watching it on Zoom, and that's got to be good. Yeah, theatre. I love that word, theatre.
Good. I'm also reminded you of your poem, Norman Stopped Me on the
Street. Oh, Norman, yeah.
I don't know whether you remember.
I do. I'll find it if you want. You want me to read it to you?
Yeah, go on then. Yeah, okay. Why not? That'd be brilliant.
If I can find it. I mean, the thing about Norman.
It's on page 160.
Have you got the page there? Page. Oh, yeah, Norman Stopped Me in the Street. And then there's a sequel to that, which I'll do both of them.
Okay.
Norman, I actually saw Norman the other day, Norman Faraday, lovely fella. See him walking up and down the village all the time. And he's a very cultivated man, a cultured man. But he, like a lot of people around here, thinks that maybe the theatre is not the space for him. He'll go and see what he calls a show, but he wants to go and see a play. Mm. And so this is him. Me on the street. People often stop me on the street and either give me poems, tell me poems, or ask me about poems. And this is Norman, and it's written in Yorkshire language. Norman stopped me on the street and he said, hey, Ian lad, I could go to theatre if I wanted, I reckon. I could sit there and clap at end and chat more, and then I'd go on and say, where have you all been? To shop, to bus stop, to wall, to shed. I've been to theatre. I've got a programme. I could do that, Ian. No stopping me, is there? And then when I read that aloud, I always go, no, there's nothing stopping you. The kind of piece. But then Norman, he started writing poems, and he often sticks them through my letterbox. But then there's a little one I wrote called Norman Came to My House, which he often does and knocks on the door. And this is that. And it's again about language and about who we are and who we represent ourselves as when we write. Norman came to my house. Two parts. One, Norman came to my house and said, "Right, Ian, I've written a poem. Can I show thee it? It don't rhyme, and it's about me thoughts about England. And it were right hard not to make it rhyme, but I think I managed it. Modern poem, that's it. Don't have to rhyme, do they? Modern poetry. I'll leave it with thee." Part two. Later, I rang Norman to talk to him about his poem. His answering machine was Norman with a phone voice. The score is Barnsley 6, Manchester United 0, and the second half is about to start. So you'll understand that I can't get to the phone right now. It's okay, Norman. I'll ring back later to talk about modern. So the idea was that Norman thought that modern poetry didn't rhyme, and also he felt that he had to put on a phone voice on the phone that wasn't his voice. And, you know, as the great poet from Leeds, Tony Harrison, said, you know, we're the ones that Shakespeare gives the comedy parts to, you know, the ones who talk like me or talk like Norman. And part of my thing all through my career has been to say, however you speak is the right way to speak. So, yeah, that's Norman, Norman Faraday. Oh, aye. Yes. Tom, again, the day, he saw him in Cleethorpes, which is about halfway through the summer, and him and his wife were walking down the prom, both wearing masks. At the time, when not many people were wearing masks. And I said to Norman, you're all right in the open air, Norman. We're by the sea. You don't have to wear your mask. He said, I'm getting used to it. Dear me.
No, it's interesting what you say about the voice and the accent. And it's not even just dialect, is it? It's because I think you know Kate Fox.
Yes, I do know Kate Fox. Yes,
she's a regular on the Verb, and she I met her at an event actually in Tunbridge actually that we were selling books at. But she said something about the sort of duality of as it I guess being an intellectual but having an accent and being able to move between two different. I don't know what it is. Two different spaces.
Two different codes, really, isn't it? I mean, people say that, you know, people say to me, "Do you put that voice on?" I said, "No, I talk like this in the house." You know, people assume that weird phrase, "professional Yorkshireman," that people level at me. You know, they say you're a professional Yorkshireman. I said, "Well, I don't quite know what that means, but this is how I speak." You know, and I think you can be intellectual and loving and subtle and nuanced in this, but. But a lot of people, you know, have it knocked out of them. So, yeah, it's Kate has stuck to she's from Bradford, isn't she, originally? She's stuck to a Bradford accent.
Yeah.
Fantastic way. Shall I give you my word, which is kind of related to what we're talking
about?
Oh,
yes, of course. Yes, please.
My word is palimpsest. I love the word palimpsest.
No.
Palimpsest is...
Really?
Yeah, oh, God, I love it. It's one of those words where writing is on top of other writing. So writing on writing on writing. Obsessed. I got told off.
That is so funny.
Yeah, go on.
It's so funny because the very first episode I recorded with my friend Ian, another Ian, Ian Tucker Bell, my word was palimpsest.
Right. Yeah, oh, well, palimpsest. Have you said it wrong all these years?
Palimpsest.
I said palimpsest. Anyway.
Oh, I don't.
Whatever
know
it is, but see, the word palimpsest itself contains mysteries. I think, the word palimpsest or palimpsest just contains the whole of writing, because it's the idea that you can write, you can rewrite, that writing is layered on top of other writing. And also, somehow, it's one of those words that it isn't quite like you'd imagine it would be. You would think that a word about writing on writing would be, I don't know, it would sound different, it would look different. So, for example, the word pulchritudinous is about beauty.
Yes.
And isn't it an odd word?
Yes.
That woman was pulchritudinous. You think, well, that's strange. Or a word like bucolic doesn't suggest what it means. And to me, the word palimpsest, because it's such a magical word, it doesn't suggest that in the word itself. So to me, the word palimpsest is a word that contains multitudes. I got told off at the Verb years ago using the word palimpsest far too often in my introduction to people. I said, look, Ian, you've passed the palimpsest limit. You're not allowed any more palimpsests at all. It is my favourite. So if we could, you and I, form a theatre company, we'll call it the Palimpsest Theatre. That's what it'll be.
I think we'd have
to. The Palimpsest Theatre of the Word. That's what it'll be.
No, it's a great word because and it's one of those words that, as you say, like pulchritudinous, and where you don't encounter them very often. And I know that, you know, I guess you're like me. You were a sort of avid library goer as a child.
Yes.
And you come across these words and you almost think, coming back to the accent and the language, you almost think, well, those words are not for
me. Yes, you do. That's exactly right.
These are words for clever people.
Yeah, you're dead right. That, and what you think, palimpsest. Yes, that's exactly what you feel. You think, well, that is a word for the clever people. That's a word that they might use. Yeah. And also, I don't know if you found this, as an avid library person, I would read writers that I really liked or thought I should read and like, but then couldn't pronounce their names. And my letdown was Goethe, who I pronounced as Goethe. And I was at first year at North Staffordshire Polytechnic. There was this girl I was talking to, and I said, yeah, I love the work of Goethe. And you think, we've all done it, you know, but hear me.
Yeah.
But it is, you're right, there are words that, when you're in the library, that leap out at you, but you think, well, they're not for me. Or they're words that actually, they just exist on the page. And if you try to say them, then you lose a bit of the magic because you mispronounce them.
Yeah, that's just true with so many names as well, isn't it? As you say, authors particularly. So as we're on that subject about the young Ian Macmillan, your dad was in the Navy. He's Scottish.
Yes, my dad was from a place called Cairn Wath, which is not far from Lanark. And my mother is from the next village to where I live in Barnsley. And they met as pen pals in the Second World War. So, it's a fantastic story. My dad, he always wanted to join the Navy. And he was born in 1919. He would have been 100 this year, many years ago. But his thing was always to join the Navy. But he lived in a kind of landlocked Lanark. Cairn Wath is not near the sea, but he wanted to join the Navy. So he joined the Navy in 1937. And my mother just lived in this local pit village and was conscripted into the WAFs in 1939 or 40. And there was a scheme that they had where single service people could write to each other. So my mum, from her base at RAF Blackbrook in near Wigan, wrote to my dad. And they had this fantastic epistolary romance where they wrote to each other for ages before they actually met. And I always put that as one of the reasons that I'm a writer, because they met through writing. They would write to each other.
Yeah.
And because it was the war, they kept trying to meet, but they couldn't because of the wartime trains. My dad would land in Plymouth and he'd get the train up, and they tried to meet at the Queen's Hotel in Leeds for afternoon tea and just miss each other. And they only met about three or four times. Then they got married on a 48-hour pass in 1943. My dad sent this telegram. He landed. He was about to land in Plymouth. He sent this telegram. They had the banns read. They were going to get married in Peebles, not far from Edinburgh. Family connections there. My dad sent this telegram that said, get leave now. And my mum sent this telegram back that said, cannot get leave. And my dad ignored that and just set off up on the train to Peebles. So my mother begged and pleaded with the staff there, because they said, look, this is the war. We might never see each other again. He was off to the South China Seas. He was in the middle of the war. And so, but they wouldn't let her go. So she went AWOL for love. She climbed over the fence and got on the train at Wigan Wallgate Station. And they had one night together in the Tontine Hotel in Peebles. Then my dad went back on secret war work. She never saw him for a year. She went back to the WAFs and got arrested for going AWOL. And the thing was, it's a fantastic story. And I think it grew in the telling, because my dad would say things like, yeah, I was really early at the church, and I saw your mother running up the main street. And my dad was stood there with a bolt of Chinese silk under his arm that his sister was going to make, that he bought from Shanghai, and his sister was going to make it into a wedding dress. We never got around to it. And the thing was, that story became their personal myth. My dad left the Navy in 1958 when I was two. My mum looked after her mother, so he came to lived in Barnsley. But every night, it felt like they would just tell that story again, you know, and I wrote a play about it for Radio 4. And it just struck me that what an astonishing story that, you know, that these two people would never, ever have met in normal life, met because of the war, met because of writing. had this romantic story. So they were both unutterable romantics because of that. So yeah, that's where they were from. So that's how I was in Barnsley, but we had this history of.
And as you say, it was about their writing.
Mm, yeah, the writing, because my dad wasn't a great speller, but his writing was, he got very excitable. So I remember him putting, "Olive, when we get together, we will have some fun." And he spelled fun with several N's. He was so excited. Tragically, I don't know why, they threw most of the letters away. I've got a couple, but not many. So I had to kind of recreate it when I wrote this play about it. But then I tried to imagine their meetings. What would they be like? What would they... They would be a bit like Brief Encounter or something. You know, they would meet and they would chat and they would try and find out about each other. And it was an amazing thing, but it started with writing. That's how it started. So that's and also my dad's auntie. My dad had got this auntie Bella, who was a Victorian poet. She was a Victorian rhyming balladeer. Yeah, but Bella Howardson lived in a place not far from Carmarthen. And she featured in this book called Modern Scottish Poets, just two or three of her ballads. They weren't great poems. They were very Victorian, but she was always seen as Aunt Bella the poet. And she would write my dad these rhyming letters. I'm sure that if rhyme and rhythm and language comes to you through your DNA, then that was it for me. It was through great Aunt Bella Howardson and my mum and dad meeting through writing. And also, I mean, the young Ian Macmillan went to school in the West Riding of Yorkshire, which I often talk about as being such a joy, because the West Riding was, in the 60s, right up to 1974, was an educational experiment. It was run by a godlike genius called Sir Alec Clegg. He was the chief education officer. Ah. And he just said, all children are creative. So in our junior school, we would sing, we would dance, we would do art, we'd have theatre, we'd have stories, and we'd write poems endlessly. So at the end of every lesson, at the end of maths, at the end of history, we would write a poem, we'd draw a picture. And the idea of the child being creative was just seen as the bedrock of everything. I was so lucky to go to a West Riding school, because it was just it just said, you can write. There's a fantastic book called The Excitement of Writing by Sir Alec Clegg, full of writing by kids from mining village schools and textile village schools. And he puts that writing, and he says, this writing is as important as Shakespeare and Dickens. So that, I'm very lucky that I had these parents and that I was born in this place where I still live. It really was the fountainhead of all the things that I've done.
Yeah, and so presumably they were completely supportive of you wanting to write.
Yeah, they were. They saw it as a... My dad always thought, he said he should get a proper job first. He was always a bit of a proper job man. Quite rightly too, you know, because he'd been in the Navy then. He left the Navy in 1958 and went to work in an office in Sheffield. And he always thought I should have a proper job. My mother, on the other hand, just said, be a writer, just be a writer. She just thought I should be a writer. But also the idea of standing up and performing I liked. So as a kid, I was in a band like every teenager is, you know, and I liked performing. I liked standing up in folk clubs and reading out. Taught me how to read and perform in public. But yeah, they were absolutely and completely supportive. And that's why I support people. That's why I said to people like Norman Faraday, carry on writing. That's why everybody I meet, I always say, carry on. If you're writing, carry on. Don't stop. Carry on. Because I've been endlessly encouraged. And that, you know, my wife encourages me, everybody. I'm so lucky. So when I gave my job up, I've been freelance now since 1983, astonishingly. And, you know, I worked in I went to college, North Staffordshire. I got a job on a building site and a job in a tennis ball factory. And then 1983, applied for this grant from Yorkshire Arts Association with a local branch of what's now the Arts Council. And it would give you up to £1,000 if you gave your job up. I applied for this £1,000. They gave me £800. Psychologically, it's a lot less. You think, well, £800. £1,000. And my wife and my parents just said, go on then, give your job up. If that's what you want to do, give your job up. And I did. And then what you realise is, as I often say, you know, you give your job up and you got your £800. And my wife was working as a teacher at the time, so we weren't skinned. You go, right, I'm here. Come on, world. Come on, I'm here. And then nothing happens. You stand there going, right, I'm ready.
Yeah.
I've had a few poems published in magazines. I've got a book coming out, but that's not going to make a living. So that's when I started doing what I've done since. Whirling round and round, doing writing workshops, performances, gigs, always saying yes. I mean, a lot of writers say this. If somebody says, can you do this? Just say yes. I'll do that. And if it doesn't work, then they won't ask you again. Go don't matter. You know, so somebody says, can you write this? Yes. It didn't work. Can you perform here? Yes. Can you do this commission? Yes. If you do that, and that's, and I did that because when I gave up my job in 1983, I thought, what am I going to do? And eventually people ask you to do stuff and you end up saying yes.
Well, that was going to be one of my other questions, was how do you make a living as a poet? But I mean, you know, it's I guess that's what you're
saying.
Yeah,
I mean, to start with, when I gave my job up, there was one or two things happening. So I would do the odd reading. There used to be a thing you might remember called the National Poetry Secretariat. Remember that? And they would do...
No, I don't remember.
It was funded by, I think, the Arts Council, and they would fund a gig for 30 quid. So you would do a gig and you'd say, it's National Poetry Secretariat. The organiser had to find 10 quid. The NPS would find the other 20 and you'd do this gig for 30 quid. So I was doing some of those. I was writing reviews for the New Musical Express, the NME, and they would pay 13 quid a review. Then I was doing a lot of writing workshops for the WEA, the Workers' Education Association. They would pay something like 15 quid for that. And so it began from that. But the actual writing of poems, you very rarely make a living from. But the actual talking about poems and performing poems and reading poems, you can make a living from, as long as you're not precious about it. I mean, you end up doing things maybe you might not do, you know, but you end up... One of the most amazing things I got asked to do years ago was to write a sonnet for Domestos, the well-known Greek. Domestos rang up and said, can you write a sonnet about Domestos? And I said, yes, I can. And they said, can it include the phrase champagne of the smallest room? I said, yes. They said, and it was National Toilet Week, and they said, we're going to build, the more I said this, the less likely it seems. We're going to build a giant wooden toilet in Leicester Square, and we're going to get you to stand in this giant wooden toilet, read the poem out. Because it's National Toilet Week, we get BBC, ITV, Channel 4, all these different, we got the radio, and the telly, and the papers. And they said, all right, I said, but they said, we've only got half an hour window in Leicester Square, because you have to rent this space. So we've got to be there at 7:30 till 8 o'clock, that's all we got. So I went down the night before, and I've written my poem, and I'm stood there with my poem, and they gave me a framed copy of my poem. I'm stood there with my poem under my arm, and I get there, I've built this toilet, this massive wooden toilet. I said, right, well, shall I go up to the toilet and start reading the poem? They went, no, it's all right, because they're not here yet from ITV and BBC. Meanwhile, this woman came up who stood next to me. I didn't know who she was. She's very small, and she's got a carrier bag. And anyway, it then occurred to me, but not to the PR people, that nobody was going to turn up. So they get a phone call from BBC, there'd been some big news item. Sorry, we can't come. ITV can't come. Channel 4 can't come. Local radio can't come. Nobody came. Nobody at all came. At 8 o'clock, these fellas had to get out of a van, dismantle this toilet. I never got to read it out. It turns out the woman was one of the people from Domestos who came to see what happened. And I said, I'm sorry about this. She went, well, it's not your fault. You know, these things happen with you. But she said, she had a carrier bag. She said, I write poems. I went, oh. She said, can I show you some of my poems? I went, yes, you can. So me and her sat in this coffee shop for about 2 hours reading her poems. And I thought, this is the most expensive poetry workshop you've ever had. And that was just me saying yes, being asked to write. And it went with these PR things. You know, I did one about Slough once, a similar kind of thing where I had to stand in front of a renter crowd in Slough writing a riposte to John Betjeman's poem about Slough that somebody had won me reading the poem out in a competition. So that kind of thing you get when you say, yes, I'll do it. And the only thing we did get from the Domestos thing was Martin Rosen, the fantastic political cartoonist, drew a cartoon for the Independent magazine. It was me, enormously fat, sat on a toilet, cooing out a poem, going, I do like that poem. And then I had him on the verb once, and he gave me a framed copy of this poem. Dear me. Oh, God.
Yeah. So really, I mean, I think your word should have been yes, shouldn't it?
Yes, definitely. Yes.
Clearly what you say most
often. I'm having to teach myself not to, you know, I'm getting older. I'm 64 now. I still like, you know, what I'm finding is everything's gone full circle for me in a way. You know, I'm partly because of lockdown, partly because of the pandemic. I'm spending more time working in community art. There's a place called DARTS in Doncaster Community Art. I'm doing workshops there for people with mental health issues, for people with Alzheimer's, I'm working in Barnsley for Barnsley Museums, doing the stuff I used to do when I first started. And it feels like, you know, I've gone on a kind of long trajectory, and now it's things are coming on. Because I'm doing fewer things. I'm learning to say no. If my wife was in this room, she'd do a hollow laugh because she knows that I find it really hard to say no. But I am slowly and gradually learning to say no. Or at least, if not no, then, well, I'll think about it.
Yeah, it's not just really being about being a poet, is it? It's doing all kinds of things. I mean,
yeah.
I know this is a really cheesy question, but A, do you have a passport? And because not everyone has, but does it still have your profession?
I don't have them on anymore.
I don't know where the passports do.
I've got a passport, but they don't. I would have put poet. I had to put wordsmith. You know what I mean? Because I don't just write poems. Yeah. You know, I write every week. I write an article for the Yorkshire Post, a little column for the Yorkshire Post. Mm. It has to be exactly 550 words, or they don't print them. I write a fortnightly column for the Barnsley Chronicle. I write a monthly column for the Dalesman. So I just love my ambition. What I love, I tell you what, I love writing poems. I love performing. I love being on the radio. But what I really love is writing columns for newspapers. Kind of dying thing. It really is, but I used to be a huge fan of Patrick Campbell in the Sunday Times. And I used to love reading Patrick Campbell. I've got all his collected columns in my book. He wrote these columns, and I thought, it was about him. It was about what he did. So for years, I had a column in the Sheffield Telegraph, and I started this one in the Barnsley Chronicle. And they used to pay me 25 quid for this column. And I said to my agent, Adrian, I said, ring them up just for a joke and see if they'll pay 28. I've been doing it for years and years and years. And they rang back and said, no, tell you what, we'll pay 30, but you can only do it once a fortnight. So I'm still doing it. You know, so once every other Saturday, I'll get up early after my stroll and write, and that's a bit longer, 850 words. I'll write me, and I just love the idea. The other person I would love, used to love reading, was Miles Kington, first in the Times. Then in the
Yes, I was going to mention him, actually. Miles Kington. As soon as you mentioned
every day, he wrote a column every day. That would be my dream, to have a daily column for a newspaper. I think, how would you do that? You know, some columns are better than others, but a lot of Miles Kington's were amazing. There was when Flann O'Brien, under his pen name Miles Nagatopoline, write those ones for the Irish Times. That was a daily.
Yeah.
You think, wow, that's like, in a sense, it's like writing a tweet. It trains the brain. You've got to write one. Sometimes, you know, when I can't sleep, I sleep very well, but not for long. But when I can't sleep, I have these fantasies about some newspaper ringing me up and going, like a daily column. One day it might happen. Gosh, that would be that.
Yeah. That's amazing, yeah.
Partly because I used to like reading the Americans like S.J. Perelman and Robert Benchley. Mm. People in the New Yorker. I still subscribe to the New Yorker. I remember the first time I went to America in 1977 on the Greyhound bus, ran out of money on the way back. And I had a dollar left. But shall I buy a burger? No, I'll buy the New Yorker. I bought the New Yorker, and I still think there's something glorious about the New Yorker. I subscribe to it, and it's not that expensive to subscribe to. And it comes, and I just read it, and there's some fantastic columns. And it's not as column-heavy as it used to be, but I used to read people like S.J. Perelman, like I said, Robert Benchley, Dorothy Parker, Robert Alexander Wolcott. And they were just amazing prose stylists who could really turn a sentence and find that an astonishingly addictive form of writing. People like Joan Didion on a separate level. She's my hero in terms of prose writing, that kind. That is, I love writing that kind of thing. I'm just going to go and switch the light on because it's getting very dim in Barnsley. So I'm looking over here.
Is it?
The light's on, the light is on.
It gets darker early.
Yes, it does. I think it does.
Yeah, I was just looking at the map because you've been in Darfield.
All my life, yeah. I just live about, half a mile from where I was born. I mean, Darfield's just a village about 5 miles out of Barnsley. It's a very old village. It was in the Doomsday Book. It's on a Roman road. There are Roman coins found here. There's an idea that maybe it was quite a big Roman settlement with a villa and stuff. Then it was an agricultural place for years and years, and then they found coal. And so from the late 19th, early 20th century, it was a pit village. And then when all the pits shut after the strike, it was in a terrible state, trying its best. to reinvent itself. And where I'm sitting, I can look across where the coal mine was, where my father-in-law worked at Oulton Main, as it was called, Oulton Main. And now what's there is big ASOS warehouse, as seen on screen, which is where people send off and buy their clothes. And it's interesting that it used to employ thousands of people. Now ASOS employs thousands of people. And when I go for my early stroll, about 20 past five in the morning, I see the ASOS bus going past with people on there going to ASOS in the same way that 30 or 40 years ago I would have seen the pit bus going past with miners on going to work. And so, Darfield is in some ways an unremarkable place, but in many ways a remarkable place because it's lived through huge cultural, social, and economic changes. And to be honest with you, I could do my job anywhere. I can't drive, but there's a bus stop at the top of the street, the stations. Mm. Doncaster, London. I like the idea that, you know, people, everybody around here knows me. You know, they know me. They're not bothered. They're not impressed. In fact, I'm on the radio, on the television.
But when you were younger, did you have that thing about wanting to get away, or was that never entered?
I think I did. I think I think as a young man, you think you should get away. My English teacher at school, one of them, Miss Gray, said, You'll never manage it. You must go to London. You must go to London. You won't be able to make it as a writer around you. Partly I was kind of disagree with that. And I thought, well, you can make it as a writer anyway. And then I thought, maybe as a young man, I thought you'd live some kind of peripatetic existence. You would live for a few years here and a few years there. But then, you know, you kind of, the place grows around you. And so we've been in this house for 35 years. And we sometimes think about, it's not a big house, only a semi-detached house, but you think, might we downsize one day? But my wife says, well, you know, the kids grew up here.
Yeah.
You know, they grew up, the garden is there, you know, they grew up playing in that garden. So I can't see myself moving, really. So maybe there was ambition when I was younger to move. I like people like George Mackay Brown, who was always on the same island in the Orkneys, or even more so, the Cumbrian poet Norman Nicholson, as far as I know, lived all his life in the house he grew up in, you know, so he never moved. And I think you can have, one of my favourite phrases, the universal in the local. The universal can be found in the local. So in this unremarkable place, the endeavour, you see bravery, you see farces, you see laughter, you see joy, you see people working hard, you see people not working hard, you see kind of Shakespearean endeavour, and you see sort of Ovian small lives. So yeah, I think anywhere you are, you can write about, you know, anywhere. In this kind of psycho-geographical Ian Sinclair way, you can. Everywhere you know, when I walk down the street in the morning, I've walked down the street for so many years, I walk past my brother's house who lives just yards away, you know, and I don't want to make it feel like it's some kind of, I don't know, like a northern cliche, but walk along streets that people have walked on for years and years and years, and I can see it, and it kind of is my wellspring. Whereas, in fact, you know, for me, Dad, he was always, he always hankered maybe to go back to Scotland. So maybe if he had gone back to Scotland. And also, we almost moved to Sheffield when I was young to be near to my dad's work. So that might all have been different.
But I suppose it ties together the words we brought along, doesn't it? I mean, you're seeing the kind of layers and layers of history and lives in the place you've always lived in.
And theatre. This place becomes a theatre. I wrote a book by my mate, the late Martin Wiley. There were a series of radio stories called the Richard Matthewman stories that were about somebody growing up in Darfield at the same time we did. And it made Darfield into a place of myth and a place of kind of broad theatrical canvas. And also, you're right, you know, the layers on this place, the layers of language, the layers of stories. If you live in the same place all your life, then inevitably, that's going to happen, you know, and you couldn't, that wouldn't happen. That something different and maybe better would happen if you live somewhere in different, for different times, you know, in different times of your life. If you live somewhere, then a writing would come out of that. So I don't know. I mean, you can only speculate, can't you? Because I am the person I am, and I can't move from here. And if I move from here now, this place would be like a long comet's tail behind me, so it would always be there,
it's interesting because it's sort of completely the opposite of what I did, because I was brought up like an hour and a half away from here.
Where was that?
In Accrington.
Accrington, fantastic. Well, I like Accrington. Gosh, I got completely lost in Accrington. I came out of the train. I was doing this thing in a school in Accrington, And this chap, I think, because he recognised my Yorkshire accent, sent me completely the wrong way. I said, excuse me, my man, which way's so-and-so school? He went, first left, second right, you can't miss it. I'm totally and utterly lost. And then the Accrington Library upstairs, but it's now a fantastic, or before the lockdown, fantastic performance space. So, yeah. Accrington, yes,
lovely. I like it. Now, that was the library I used to go to, yeah.
But it's a fantastic building, isn't it? It really is.
Mm, absolutely, yeah. And there used to be a children's library around the corner from it, a dedicated building that was
proper
a children's
library.
Yeah.
So where did you go after that then? Where were you after Accrington?
Well, then I went to university in London. So
yeah,
that was really, yeah, getting away from home. So it's, I guess, you know, you do make these choices, but you kind of wonder. I mean, I admire that the resolve, the vision that you have that you can do your career anywhere.
In my job, you can be a writer anyway, particularly these days, you know, internet, you know, you can be a writer anyway. It was interesting when the first 10 years of its life, The Verb was in London. And then from 2002 to 2012, then in 2012, the show moved to Salford. Interesting that in the London Radio 3 people said, good news, Ian, you're moving to Salford. I said, you think the North is a very small island and that Salford's just on the next beach? Whereas in fact, it takes me 20 minutes longer to get to Salford. Because
it does it really?
To London, yeah, it's amazing. It's about 40 miles as the crow flies. But if I went to London, I would get the bus to Doncaster, which took 20 minutes. Then I get a train to London, which took an hour and a half. Now I have to get the bus to Barnsley, train to Huddersfield, train to Manchester, tram to Salford. It takes 20 minutes longer. So strange.
But
that's the pull of London, isn't it? I guess that's the pull of London. Yeah. If HS2 ever happens, we'll be able to say, I'm just going to pop to London. And that's the thing. I've done that myself. You know, you've popped down for something in London.
And you've always, as you say, you don't drive, so you've always taken the train.
The driving was, I mean, I did have a couple of lessons when I was 17 with a man who was more nervous than me. In the end, I wrote a story about it with this Richard Matthewman thing because he was so nervous, this fella. And then I got in the car because I thought I should learn to drive. Because all your mates are learning to drive this way. I got in the car at the top of our road and he said, instead of saying grip the wheel at 10 to 2, he said grisp the wheel at 10 past 2. I held the steering wheel. And he smacked me on the arm. He said, no, it's so stupid. So we set off down the street. This is awesome. And we got to this chapel, the Methodist chapel at the bottom of Barnsley Road. He said, look, I've just got to pop in the chapel and get something. I won't be a minute. Stay here. So I'm in the car, and he's gone for about 10 minutes. And I thought, well, something's gone wrong. So I went in the chapel. This is true. Stood at the pulpit, mumbling from the Bible. It turned out he double-booked my driving lesson with his portion of a 24-hour sponsored Bible reading. He said, I won't be a minute. I said, forget it. This is some kind of sign. Driving's not for me. So I never had another lesson. And the thing was, in those days, because this was the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, you could get anywhere on the bus for 2p. You could get to Barnsley for 2p. You could get to Sheffield for 8p, I think it was. And also, you know, the buses went all day and they were late at night. These days, the only time I wish I could drive is that sometimes you'll do a gig somewhere and it's not that far away, but the last train's gone. So you end up staying over in a hotel or in someone's house, when in fact, if you could drive, you'd be home in an hour. That's the only fact. The thing about the trains and buses is, because trains are worse than buses, buses are all right, but because the trains up until lockdown have been so terrible in terms of reliability, I always end up getting the train at least an hour before the one I want to get. Yeah. It might be late. So I've spent most of my life sitting in railway buffets because they'll say, right, you've got to be there for 10 a.m. I'll be there for 8 a.m. because I just don't trust them. Oh, but I made a radio program called The Late Ian McMillan about being early because I am pathologically, ridiculously early because I think it gives you a sense of power. Like if I'm doing a gig in a Billy Joel, sometimes they don't lock them. So me and my mate will arrive. We're meant to be there at 5 o'clock. We'll arrive at half past 4 or 4 o'clock. You can get in and then it's your space. Theatre thing again. Mm. Here I am in my space. I'll rearrange the seats. This is where we are. This is where it is. Then when the organisers come, I welcome them into my space. And that's why I like to welcome the audience when I do a gig. I like to stand at the front and say, hello, I'm just welcome them all in and give them a free postcard and stuff. Because
that sounds great.
That's, but yeah, that's about being early. So yeah, that's me not driving. Yeah. And I won't learn now, it's a bit late.
No,
my son, my son's also a poet and he don't drive, so poets don't drive.
Oh, that's Andrew, yeah.
Andrew, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I think Arthur Smith, who doesn't drive, said much the same thing. Poets don't drive.
Well, in fact, Wendy Cope calls us tumps, typically useless male poets.
That's right, yes, yeah. but I was going to ask about your gigging then. So obviously that's kind of, it's all on hold really, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is. Which is a shame. I love it. I absolutely love performing in public. It's a thing that I just feel most alive. I'm standing in front of an audience. The last performance I did was in March at Penistone Paramount Cinema. It's part of the Penistone Festival. And it's a fantastic venue. I did a gig, just read poems. We had a fantastic laugh. And at the end, I said to the organiser, the wonderfully named Brian Barnsley, I said, what's going to happen, Brian? He said, well, I've had to cancel an AC/DC tribute act. I said, oh, maybe things aren't going to go so well. But at the time, we thought, well, we all thought, didn't we? It might be a month, might be 2 months. Then the gigs started getting cancelled and then rebooked. So they cancel a gig in the spring and it will be rebooked for now, and they've got cancelled. Stuff that's now booked for January, February is being cancelled. People are saying we might get something going in the early summer. But the thing about the village halls, the thing about my demographic, they're all people my age and above, to be honest with you. So I get a lot of people in the 60s, village halls, people in the 70s. They're a bit nervous of turning out, you know. So I don't know what's going to happen. I miss it so much. I miss just that thing of walking into a room and just standing up in a room and performing. The smaller room, the better for me. My mate Luke, the musician that I work with, he says he likes performing big rooms. I say, no, give me a village hall with 30 people in it. Oh, that's great. Just a room with some people in. I've started doing, like a lot of folk musicians do, like doing house gigs. Somebody will book you to do a gig in their house because I'm always looking for new venues. Now, I noticed that on folk musicians' itineraries, it would say Art Centre, Village Hall, Pub, then it would say house performance. I thought, well, what is that? And it turns out it is this invisible circuit of people performing in people's houses. And, of course, you can't advertise it because you can only get 25 people in the house, so you don't want 100 people. I've done several of them, and they're interesting because you might get 30 people, they all pay a tenner, and you get the money straight away. It cuts out the middleman, as it were. But it is an invisible circuit. But the trouble is, you can't do anything like that lockdown because the idea of social distancing gone completely. So I do love performing, and who knows? Who really knows when it'll get back to what it was before? Let's hope so.
Yeah, well, when it does get back, they'll definitely invite you down to Tunbridge.
I'd love to.
And sort something out there and buy you that pie or custom.
Oh, the pie, the natter, the wonderful natter of Portugal. Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but so what are you doing to kind of keep yourself busy, or is that a silly question?
I'm still doing the regular columns, so they keep me going. I'm writing a little bit of a book, about a kind of travel book about the coast. I've been little bits about that. I've been writing, Barnsley Council made me their poet in lockdown. So I've been writing these sonnets in lockdown. I thought I'll write sonnets because sonnet is an interesting technical exercise as much as anything else. And I wanted people to write their sonnets and send them in. So I've been writing these sonnets. We've been putting them on the website, the Hear My Voice Barnsley website, and encouraging people to send them in. A man in Darfield called Ken Brooks, a bit like Norman, he'd never written sonnets before, suddenly been bitten by the sonnet bug. He keeps writing sonnets on Twitter. Ian, I've only written 5 today. You know, so I've been doing quite a lot of that. I've been doing loads of reading for The Verb. I've been doing lots of community artwork in Doncaster, often on Zoom, often because we can't meet with these people, creating podcasts. So yeah, I've kept myself busy, but what I really have missed is getting in the car with my mate Luke and him driving us down to some village hall somewhere and just making a gig and then coming back late at night. But you know, that'll come back. And if it doesn't to the same extent, then you know, I'll just regard it as a fantastic time in my life and just think, well, I'll keep writing. Going.
Well, I sincerely hope that's not the case.
No, so do I.
Yeah. Well, I shall have to go at a sonnet then, won't I?
So yeah, and the great thing about a sonnet is, I mean, Don Paterson said it, that the rhyme will hand you other rhymes that you hadn't thought of. And they do get a bit addictive, I've got to say. The Shakespearean, the Petrarchan, the Spenserian, all these different kinds of sonnets. They train the brain in the same way that a tweet does. They make you think creatively. So they can, as I say, they can get addictive. You can think, I want to think outside this sonnet area sometimes. They're very good for reading and writing for an audience that aren't used to reading poetry. They'll think, oh, this looks like a proper poem. This is a proper poem.
Right.
Then they can have a go at writing their own. Yeah, definitely.
So that's been your kind of lockdown project then?
It has really, yeah. And I got a fantastic heckle from a car. I love getting heckled from cars. There being the thing in the bars of Chronicle about, he's our poet in lockdown. As soon as she added, you should be locked up.
God bless you. Yeah. So have you got big plans then for, I mean, lots of people are sort of kind of planning what to do post vaccine, I suppose. And,
my ambition, what I'd like to do, there's lots of things I want to do post-vaccine in terms of performing. I'm desperate to go to, when we can do this, back to, there's a pub in Sheffield called the Lesker that puts on jazz, and I love jazz. So my thing is to go to the Lesker on a Wednesday night. There's going to be loads of people there. We don't have to social distance. There's going to be somebody playing avant-garde jazz. It sounds like, as Andy Kershaw called it, a fire in a passion. I don't drink a lot, but I might have a drink of beer. That's what I'm looking forward to, just this thing of being close to people. Because my wife keeps telling me, distance, you know, not with her, obviously, but just with people when I meet somebody. Distance, Ian, because I'm a chap who likes to be close to people. I love being close to people. And this has been the worst bit, you know, to stand yards away from people. So what I'm looking forward to most is being close to people. And being really close to people in a room where there's a bit of jazz playing, a bit of poetry going on, and just so. And I think I'm hoping that's going to happen. I really do hope it will.
Yeah. And as this goes out, just before Christmas, what's the Macmillan family Christmas normally like, and what's it going to be like this time?
Well, normally it's just a fantastic thing where all the kids and my mother-in-law and everybody come on Christmas Eve. We have a nice party, and then all the kids come on Christmas Day, and then we go to my sister-in-law's house on Boxing Day. We go to my mother-in-law's house on the evening of Christmas Day. But instead, we're going to have to, like everybody else, just do it in shifts, you know. So get one daughter and husband on Christmas Eve, get the other daughter on Christmas Day. I'm not looking forward to that, you know. I love Christmas so much. It's my favourite thing. I said to my wife, let's just regard it another day. Let's let it go. But in fact, you know, we are being loosened a bit, aren't we? So we've got to make the best of it. But the worst bit will be, you know, not that the grandkids would normally be around, all of them. But that's not gonna, you know, it'll pass. It's just a day. I have a slightly different attitude to Christmas because sadly, but also kind of gloriously, my dad died on Christmas Day 2001. And my dad was like me, a huge, huge Christmas fan. And to lose your dad on Christmas Day, it's an odd thing, you know. But I remember he liked singing, my dad, and he would sing all the time. And I remember him dying on Christmas Day in Barnsley Hospital. The night before, I'd been to see him, and the nurses said, I said, how is he? And she said, are you asking me if he's going to die? I said, yeah. She said, he won't die today. I think he's going to die tomorrow. And I said, all right. She said, anyway, we've got him a present. That's what we do. And so they got him a present, and the present was some aftershave and deodorant. Mm-hmm. I opened it for him. He was laying there in his bed, and he didn't know what it was. But I remember opening this thing. I thought, oh, there you go. Going to the next room, smelling nice. So, you know, I don't know. It was a horrible thing, but also it felt kind of fitting that somebody ends their life on the day they love them all. Yeah, I'm kind of looking forward to Christmas, but I'm looking forward to next Christmas even more.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, thank you, Ian. I don't want to take up any more of your time.
Thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I hopefully we will meet in the real world.
I think we will. We will. We
have that cup of tea or that pie and that chat. If you can bear to get the train all the way down to the southeast of England, we'll look after you.
All right. Thank you very much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Ian. So that's Ian McMillan, a lovely chap. And a really encouraging and positive perspective on writing, and that idea of creating spaces for writing to happen. It sounds a bit weak to say he makes poetry accessible, but he definitely does, and it's always engaging and entertaining and thought provoking. His book, To Fold the Evening Star, is, I think, a brilliant introduction to his writing, and it embeds poetry in real life, as well as embedding his real life in the poetry itself. And it's not just funny, although it is quite often, it's also quite challenging. And you'll see what I mean about creating spaces for the words to act if you read it. And of course, you can order a copy of Ian's book, To Fold the Evening Star, or any of his others by calling into Mr. Books or going online to www.mrbooks.co.uk. We have another very exciting guest, I'm seriously excited about this, coming up in the new year. So if you don't want to miss that, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, acast.com being one of the best. Ideas in Writing is supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of independent, inspiring and imaginative books, gifts and conversation, including an exclusive range of book-related and Mr. Books-inspired T-shirts. Whatever you buy from us helps to support an independent bookshop. So if you're listening to this before Christmas, I hope it's smashing. And if you're listening after Christmas, let's hope 2021 is proving to be a great year. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.